This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Climate change. That's the economic story, really. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, 2 September. Good, as always, to have you along. Where do you start with the economic effects of the weather and the climate in this country the past week or so? Hundreds of thousands of people without power along the Gulf Coast. They've had to evacuate and leave their property and their jobs behind. The flooding last night along the East Coast, more than 20 people killed in New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania. The subway system in the biggest and richest city in this country underwater, literally. I'm sure you've seen the videos. The insurance claims, surely in the tens of billions of dollars. The investment that's going to be needed to manage and to adapt to the effects of climate change. Well, as we have seen this week, we are not ready. Starting, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, with much of our housing stock.
Nearly a third of homes in the U.S. are at high risk of natural disasters, according to CoreLogic, and low-income communities are especially vulnerable.
These homes, you know, haven't been updated, haven't gotten consistent reinvestment, rehabilitation, retrofitting over the years.
Khalil Shaheed is a senior policy advisor with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says there is federal funding to help weatherize homes by, say, switching out single-pane windows for sturdier double-pane glass. But Shaheed says roof repair, one of the most expensive and important fixes, isn't eligible.
You know, once the roof goes, then, you know, you get, you know, the wind damage, then you get rain damage. So it just really compounds the severity of a storm like this one.
Chriselle Palais is executive director of the Home Coalition, which advocates for more equitable recovery from disaster. She says wealthier, whiter neighborhoods tend to be better protected in the first place and have the means to come back more quickly. She lives in a historically Black neighborhood in Houston, where many people are still recovering from Hurricane Harvey 4 years ago.
I could step outside of my house and look to the right and look to the left and see blue tarps still in people's houses.
And she says not enough has changed to prevent the next flood. Her neighborhood has an open ditch drainage system that often gets blocked with trash.
We have some people that try to get out there and clean it out themselves, but that really is the responsibility of the city. And sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't.
There are smaller things people can do, like making sure gutters are clean and there's a sump pump in the basement. Caroline Blakely is CEO of Rebuilding Together, which helps low-income homeowners make repairs.
But once you get a major flood like we've seen over the last few days, it's pretty tough to prepare for that.
Preparing for all climate change will bring is going to take an enormous investment in, yes, infrastructure. The Biden administration is using this week's storm to push Congress even harder to make that possible. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
All right, go ahead. You name me something that's going to put a dent in Wall Street's optimism, would you? Because I am out of ideas. Record highs again at the corner of Wall Street and Broad in a very soggy lower in Manhattan on this Thursday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Economic news doesn't always make sense, we will grant you that, but this morning's regular report on first-time claims for unemployment gives us a chance to revisit that challenge anew. 340,000 people applied for jobless benefits for the first time last week. That is a pandemic low and an indicator that businesses are managing to stave off layoffs even as the Delta variant does what it is doing. On the other hand, though, as regular listeners of this show well know, there's been recent news of consumer moods, shall we say, wavering. Marketplace's Amanda Peacher makes the connection between the two for us.
There's one big obvious connection between consumer confidence and lower unemployment claims. When people are working, they feel okay about spending their paychecks, says Lynn Franco with the Conference Board.
So as long as we see consumers somewhat upbeat about their job, they're much more willing to make purchases, especially discretionary purchases.
So even though we're hearing that discretionary spending on travel and entertainment have slowed down because of Delta, lower jobless claims are a good signal. But there is a however here.
However, over the past month or so, that layoff level has pretty much stabilized.
Brad McMillan is with Commonwealth Financial and says the drop in unemployment claims has slowed.
And that's despite the fact that we're seeing strong hiring, we're seeing strong demand. So that number is a little bit misleadingly cheerful.
Keep in mind also, consumer spending on the whole could change once federal pandemic unemployment benefits expire on Labor Day.
We're not really out of the woods yet for a lot of folks who haven't gone back to work.
That's Rebecca Dixon, Executive Director of the National Employment Law Project.
And knowing that 70% of our economy is consumer spending, I just don't see any way that there can't be an impact on the recovery.
And those $600 weekly pandemic benefits will end for about 7.5 million people next week. Gig workers, those who used up state benefits, or parents who couldn't work for health or childcare reasons. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
I'm pretty sure David Brancaccio's basement got flooded last night in that storm. So Andy Euler is going to be in for him tomorrow morning, I think, on the Marketplace Morning Report. But no matter who's in charge, listen, would you? These have been a tumultuous couple of weeks for the subscription video site OnlyFans. It got real popular during the pandemic, you might know this, thanks in large part to sexually explicit content. A couple of weeks ago, though, the company said it was going to ban that content. There was lots of pushback, including from sexual content creators who'd come to rely on the income they made on OnlyFans. And then the company backed down and reversed the policy change. But creators and their allies are keeping up the pressure, including this week protests against businesses they say discriminate against legal sex work. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one for us.
OnlyFans became popular with sex workers because it helped them do something many have been trying to do for decades, control their own content and cut out some of the intermediaries.
They don't have a boss at a strip club or an agent at a talent agency running their shoots for them.
That's an OnlyFans content creator who goes by Taylor. We're not using her full name to protect her privacy.
And this is not something that people were able to do 5 or 10 years ago.
And it has been lucrative. Taylor says she makes $6,000 to $10,000 a month on OnlyFans from between 1,000 and 1,300 subscribers to her content. Nude photos, videos of her on her own or with partners, trans fetish scenes, and some of her friends, she says, earn even more.
We do this work because there's a demand for it. And it's legal work. It's consensual, legal work. And if there wasn't a demand for it, we wouldn't be doing it and we wouldn't be making so much money.
For a few years, OnlyFans was happy to take its 20% cut. Then in August, it announced its policy change. Its adult content creators were angry, but they weren't all that surprised.
Well before the OnlyFans ban, right? Sex workers have been dealing with the effects of systemic banking and financial discrimination.
Angela Jones teaches sociology and studies online sex work at Farmingdale State College. She says, for example, sex workers have trouble using online payment platforms.
American Express, Cash App, Chase Bank, I don't want to leave any out, PayPal, Venmo, right? It just as examples, there's far more than that. Already have policies refusing to process payments for sex workers. And that's across erotic industries, right? Including those like porn that are legal.
Major credit cards stopped working with Pornhub after allegations that the platform wasn't doing enough to block videos of child exploitation and non-consensual content. That move didn't elicit so much outcry. But OnlyFans was full of celebrities and new performers who turned to making adult content during the pandemic. Alana Evans is president of the Adult Performance Artists Guild.
And so now everyone is so comfortable with this idea of sexuality that is attached to OnlyFans that when it became under attack, I think your average person felt that their own freedoms were being attacked.
The idea that some sex work is more respectable than others is something people in the industry call the whorearchy.
So the hierarchy is both within sex worker communities, but also in terms of how outsiders understand sex work.
Heather Berg is author of the book Porn Work and teaches gender studies at Washington University in St. Louis.
Where in-person work, such as the escorting, is understood really in many ways at the bottom of that hierarchy. But OnlyFans, through its mainstreaming, you know, curried some public favor, some kind of sense of legitimacy.
For those whose full-time career is making adult content, the payments issue is an ongoing problem. Industry organizers are pressuring MasterCard, for example, to alter policy changes around age and consent requirements. MasterCard told us its policies are focused on making sure platforms selling adult content and the banks that serve them have enough controls to prevent illegal content and that it doesn't prohibit legal adult activity. For the OnlyFans content creator we're calling Taylor, she says the last few weeks have been a reminder of how precarious her work can be. She's solidifying her other income streams, pet and wedding photography, and dog training.
Buddy, you can't squeak while I'm talking. We're going to have to do something about this. He's a puppy.
She says she hasn't lost many clients, and she has a business degree, which she says helps her navigate the changing terms of service on various platforms. She told her subscribers that she joined an OnlyFans competitor, and she's part of a community of trans women sex workers who share information and resources.
I am going to make sure that I'm not in a position where if something like this happens, I don't feel like the rug was pulled out from under me. And I know a lot of other girls are thinking the same thing.
Like her, they're diversifying their income and joining new platforms, including some run by sex workers themselves. OnlyFans declined to comment for this story. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think we're all familiar with meme stocks.
Well, if you're not, though, stick around, huh? First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 131 points today, 0.3%, 35,443. The NASDAQ found 21 points, about a 0.1%, 15,331. The S&P 500 gained 12, 0.2%, 45,036. Heard from Amy about housing and climate change. Beacon Roofing Supply and Home Depot both up 1 2/10% today. First Solar up 0.8%. $848.98. That's how much families with elementary school children might end up spending on back-to-school stuff this year. That's according to the National Retail Federation. And it is $59 more than last year. So in back-to-school stocks, Lands' End released better than expected earnings today, nonetheless down 9 1/10%. ODP Corporation, that is Office Max, and Depot fell 1 2/10%. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note 1.29%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Take your pick. Would you? Wildfires out here in the West, hurricanes and tropical storms and all that flooding on the Gulf Coast and in New York City last night and Philadelphia, too. Hotter hots and just general climate instability as the world gets warmer and then how we adapt to it, as Amy was saying up at the top of the program. The next big global summit on climate change happens in November in Glasgow, Scotland. COP26, COP26, it's called, billed as our next best chance to save the planet. The British government says the UK is the best place to have that meeting, having committed, as Premier Boris Johnson has, to net zero emissions by 2050. In the absence of any recent large-scale opinion surveys on the subject, though, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been doing his own research, and it turns out the Brits don't seem quite as excited about going green as their government does.
At the Balham Boxing Club, a fight is underway.
Come on, Tyrone, work it back. Work it back. Use your jab. Use that jab, Tyrone. Tyrone, jab.
But the boxers are only sparring. The real fight is for the survival of the club. The battle is with the weather.
Basically, we've had a flood like numerous amount of occasions, but the last time over the weekend was the worst.
Club secretary Natasha Fuller says heavy rainfall flooded the gym in July, knocked it out of commission for a week and ruined a lot of equipment.
We've lost like running machines, chairs that we use for the show when we do shows here, lockers, cross trainers, weights. Oh, we've lost so many different equipment.
If this climatic battering continues, says club founder Winston Fuller, this much-loved non-profit gym, which has been keeping young people off the streets and out of trouble for more than 30 years, may have to close, a casualty of climate change.
Climate change is
climate
happening.
Climate change is happening. It's in front of us. It's going on. We need to do something drastic to stop it. It's going on.
But while he agrees that morally Britain should reduce its carbon emissions, he'd most like to see the local government upgrade the drains around his gym.
They need new drains that can take the water.
Adapting infrastructure is more important than cutting carbon, he says. Since Britain's emissions are only 1% of the global total, it won't make much practical difference if Britain does cut them.
And if China, India, America doesn't, we're wasting time. So I think adaptation is more priority than reducing emissions.
To test the general attitude to reducing emissions through mitigation, I've come here, 100 miles north of London, to the city of Peterborough, which also suffered a severe flood during the summer. The water, you can hear, by the way, is the far more welcome sound of fountains in the central square. Here I met, among other members of the public, Anthony Monk, Susan Gray and Peter Smith, who all expressed doubts about the electrification of transport by 2030.
We are not yet ready in a position to produce enough electricity to charge the cars that we could sell.
I think we're way off having the logistical arrangements in place for people to feel comfortable.
What are they going to do? Put a plug on every lamppost? It won't come off. It won't come off, none of it.
If the government succeeds in weaning the Brits off petrol, it would lose billions in tax that it currently levies on that fuel. The likeliest replacement is road pricing, charging for every mile of road the driver travels. Not popular with another member of the public here, Philip Rowe.
Paying, say, pence per mile, it's a huge cultural wrench for the Brits to start doing something like that.
To be fair, in this unscientific survey, some of the people I met in Peterborough, like Will Council, are prepared for whatever mitigation the government throws at them.
You'd be happy to bear the cost of some of these measures?
Yeah, certainly. It's got to be done.
To save the planet?
Yeah.
But far more common was this reaction from local resident Tony Williams.
I don't think we should be actually sitting there worrying about our global footprint. It's all the bigger countries, Europe, America, China, that are really the ones that need to say, that's it, we're cutting this, we're cutting that.
What about leading by example, though?
But we're tiny. We're absolutely tiny.
Pollsters say a large majority of Brits accept that climate change is real and at least partly man-made. But who pays for mitigation may be another matter. In Peterborough, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Harley Davidson, Hog, H-O-G. Get it? Harley Davidson, Hog, the motorcycles. Petco is Woof, W-O-O-F. I think that's pretty good, right? Ferrari, Race, R-A-C-E. Ticker symbols is what those are. And it turns out they can matter for more than just ease of corporate recall. Kitty Greifeld reports for Bloomberg, where she recently wrote about the growing competition, the market really, for memorable ticker symbols. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What is it about these ticker symbols? Because this piece you wrote is fascinating. It's six-figure prices and people want them, and it's just there's a lot going on.
Yeah. So there's been kind of this ticker gray market to emerge in specifically for ETFs because tickers really matter. I mean, it's the 3-4-letter symbol that identifies stocks and funds. And in this story, we included a 2019 study by Pomona College, which found that tickers that are actual English words, they tend to be easier to trade. They have greater liquidity, lower spreads, and they're more popular with individual investors, with retail traders.
Right. ETFs, we should say, are essentially mutual funds that trade like stocks, just so nobody gets confused. But the case in point in this piece you did and that your entry into this gray market was literally meme, M-E-M-E, and the chase for that ticker. Give me the elevator version of that story, elevator pitch.
Okay, so by now I think we're all familiar with meme stocks.
Yeah.
So I actually found out there was an issuer that was sitting on the meme ticker symbol.
Just like squatting on it? Just like had it?
Yeah. I wouldn't say squatting. I think they were trying to design the best strategy to live up to the name because the meme ticker, it's like the holy grail
of
tickers right now.
That's right. There's some pressure. Yeah.
It's a lot of pressure. So I found out who was holding it. It was Roundhill Investments. And in talking with them, I found out that actually, unrelated to meme, someone had actually tried to buy one of their live tickers off of them for $250,000 unsolicited. So I had to try to buy meme. Why not? And I wasn't successful, obviously. They actually did finally file with the SEC for a fund late in August with the ticker meme.
Does $250,000 for a ticker symbol not seem insane to you?
Yeah, you know, my first reaction to that was like, wow, that's a lot of money just for four letters. But then you think about it. I was asking Will Hershey of Roundhill, why wouldn't he sell it to me? I got up to $500,000 and he still said no.
Half a million fantasy dollars. Because, I mean, unless Bloomberg's buying, right, you don't have $500,000.
Yeah, funny money, you could call it.
I didn't
get as far as to think what would happen if I actually tried to submit that expense report. but Hershey's logic was that, you know, this fund could take off. The fees and the flows that this fund could attract, in his view, is worth well more than $500,000.
How much of the rise in the importance of, and look, a good ticker symbol has always been important, but how much of the rise of this gray market is because of the rise of retail investing, which has, of course, led to meme stocks and all of that. But there are more lay people, for lack of a better term, getting into the market now, right?
It's hand in glove. The rise of retail and their interest specifically in thematic ETFs, which are ETFs that invest along a theme like robotics or electric vehicles or disruptive companies. And there's fewer cool tickers to go around because we've seen so many SPACs and companies come public in the past year that it has created this arms race to get the best, most memorable ticker popular for your fund.
It has to be pointed out that a good or memorable ticker symbol is a relatively small part of the equation, right? Because if you've got Meme, but you're managing that fund terribly, you ain't going to make a lot of money and people aren't going to give you their money to manage.
Exactly, yeah. We have seen a few not so successful attempts at it. We had the VanEck Vector Social Sentiment ETF with the ticker Buzz, which is a very good ticker.
Yeah.
Hasn't really done that well. And part of the reason why is because it rebalances monthly. And when we're talking about meme stocks, that's like a year in meme land. So
right.
It's not just the ticker. You actually have to have the performance and the strategy to back it up.
Kitty Greifeld, she writes for Bloomberg, also Bloomberg Quick Take. Kitty, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Kai.
This final note on the way out today comes to us from the Allbirds filing for an initial public offering this week. Allbirds, of course, the oh-so-trendy footwear company. Anyway, deep in that filing, this tidbit under the category heading Market Opportunity. In 2018, the company says, citing data from the American Apparel and Footwear Association, the average American consumer spent $1,100 on footwear and apparel and bought 7 pairs of shoes. Really? I don't know. 7 new pair of shoes a year just seems like a lot. Maybe that's just me. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context. If Mitchell Hartman had been on duty today, this would have been an item from the Marketplace desk of Economic Peril. Goldman Sachs says in a research note, it's cutting its estimate for third quarter economic growth from 5.25% to 3.5%. Yes, that would still be really good historically, but I don't know. Down a lot. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's a speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.